On the morning of December 11, 2008, the calm inside a Manhattan penthouse broke the moment federal agents stepped through the door. Bernie Madoff stood in the living room, dressed in a quiet gray sweater, hands steady at his sides. He did not argue or stall. He told them the truth in one short line. It was all one big lie. For decades, he had taken in billions, sending out statements that showed gains that never existed. The numbers were fiction. The trust was real. Investors believed he was the man who could guide them through every storm. They believed because the returns never dipped. They believed because he acted like the safest mind on Wall Street. They believed because no one wanted to think a legend could be building a trap this large. As agents waited for him to continue, Madoff let the long silence settle. Behind him, a lifetime of praise was about to collapse. Chapter 1. The illusion. The agents who walked into Bernie Madoff's penthouse on December 11, 2008, believed they were entering a crime scene in progress. What they did not yet understand was how far back the trail went. To trace it, investigators later had to rebuild a timeline that stretched across nearly half a century. The fraud did not begin with a crisis. It began with a reputation. That reputation was crafted through charm, timing, and a talent for convincing people that his word was proof. Bernard Lawrence Madoff entered Wall Street during the 1960s, when the market still relied on chalkboards and handwritten tickets. He founded Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities in 1960. He was young, confident, and restless. He understood that the financial world was moving toward technology long before most of his peers were ready to hear it. The firm started small, focusing on order execution. Madoff insisted that his operation was faster and cleaner than its competitors. Clients followed because he sold speed like it was certainty. In the early years, nothing about his public work hinted at crime. His firm helped build the modern market structure. He became known as a pioneer in electronic trading. By the mid-1980s, he was a respected market maker. He joined committees. He shaped rules. He chaired the NASDAQ in 1990. These achievements would later shield him. When people doubted his results, they reminded themselves he was the man who built part of the system they depended on. They assumed that meant safety. At the same time, inside a quieter part of the business, he built something else. He created an advisory arm that he kept separate from the major trading operation. The advisory business would later be known as the engine of the fraud. When questioned, he called the investment strategy split-strike conversion. He described it as a steady options-based approach designed to protect principal and deliver mild, dependable gains. The pitch worked because it sounded technical without sounding reckless. Most people did not fully understand the method, but they trusted the man explaining it. His strategy showed smooth returns year after year. They did not surge. They did not crash. They looked exactly like the line investors wished they could see in real life. During downturns, when major funds struggled, his numbers stayed calm. He claimed it was discipline. He claimed it was experience. They believed him because he sounded confident and because people they admired spoke highly of him. The illusion of exclusivity made the scheme stronger. Investors often talked about trying to get access to his fund. Some waited months, some waited years. He played the part of the reluctant genius. He said he would review the request. He said the pool was nearly full. He said he needed to protect existing clients. These delays made people want him more. When he finally allowed a new investor in, they treated it like a privilege. He rarely had to ask for money. People lined up to give it to him. Feeder funds stabilized the flow. These were outside managers who gathered billions from their own clients and funneled the money to Madoff. He became the quiet backbone of complex networks of trusts, charities, banks, and private investors. A large number of clients never met him. They dealt with managers who swore by him. They received glossy statements, saw monthly growth, and told friends that Madoff was the safest choice in an unpredictable world. He maintained this image with careful control. The returns were always plausible. They were never too high. They were never too low. They were just right. The steadiness muted suspicion. People do not look closely at what they believe is protecting them. The calm numbers encouraged complacency. Clients built long-term plans around him. They used his statements as proof of financial security. Inside his office, the falsified statements were printed on aging machines. No one outside that room knew how the numbers were produced. They saw the results, but not the process. Madoff understood that most investors judged safety by trust, not by evidence. He used that instinct. He used it well. During the 1990s and early 2000s, some analysts and competitors noticed problems that did not add up. They tried to replicate his strategy. Their models failed. They looked at market conditions and compared them to his performance. It did not match. To them, the numbers suggested something was wrong. They warned colleagues. They wrote letters. They argued that no one could deliver consistent returns across every market condition using the method he claimed. But Madoff's status muted their concerns. He looked like the last man on Wall Street who would need to cheat. He had built a respected trading firm. He had served in high-level positions. He had supported charities. He had cultivated an image of modesty. Critics who questioned him often faced pushback from people who had known him for decades. It was easier to assume the skeptics were missing something. He also understood how to deflect doubt. When confronted with questions, he did not panic. He dismissed the concerns with a steady tone. He called the critics jealous. He called them uninformed. He called their analysis flawed. For many investors, this calm confidence was enough. They had already decided he was trustworthy. They had already built their plans around him. Challenging him meant questioning their own decisions. The fraud grew because it fed on human nature. People are drawn to what looks safe. They follow the advice of friends. They avoid digging into complex strategies that seem to be working. They believe their money is secure if the person managing it appears to be respected. Madoff understood this. He built the illusion around those instincts. He used real financial language. He used real market trends. The difference was that none of it matched the actual trades he reported. Behind closed doors, the operation remained simple. New money came in, old money went out, gains were transferred on paper. Losses did not happen because he refused to record them. The scheme survived because it was fed constantly. As long as clients did not withdraw too much at the same time, the illusion held. By the early 2000s, independent analysts again questioned his consistency. They compared his supposed returns to known market volatility. They studied his strategy. They concluded that his results defied math. But they were voices on the outside. Madoff's reputation continued to protect him. People assumed the critics did not understand the full picture. Regulators investigated at various points. They requested documents. They visited his office. Nothing came of it. Investigators were told that the advisory business was separate. They were given partial answers and assurances. He used his credibility inside the financial world to present himself as a cooperative and respected veteran. Regulators accepted explanations they should have challenged. It was not an intentional defense at every step. It was a structure built on assumptions. They assumed he was honest. They assumed the questions were minor. They assumed the paperwork was consistent with normal operations. Throughout this period, investors continued to pour in money. The split strike conversion explanation remained the story he repeated. It was vague enough to discourage close inspection and technical enough to sound legitimate. Monthly statements reinforced the illusion. Clients saw slow, steady growth. They found comfort in that stability. In uncertain markets, they clung to it even more tightly. By the mid-2000s, some competitors expressed frustration. They knew the returns could not be real, but they could not prove why. They warned institutions to reconsider. Those warnings rarely gained traction. Investors pointed to decades of clean results. They pointed to his industry roles. They pointed to his long history of trust. Many believed that if there were any real concerns, regulators would have intervened. They assumed the oversight system worked. Madoff built the illusion with routine. He showed up to work early. He kept a predictable schedule. He maintained the appearance of discipline. Routine is reassuring. People trust what feels stable. Clients saw his calm demeanor and interpreted it as proof of control. In reality, the stability was an act. The real operation depended on constant flow. The moment that flow stopped or slowed, the entire structure would begin to crack. The illusion held because it was not extravagant. It presented itself as ordinary, His investors were not promised excitement. They were promised reliability. That is what made the fraud so effective. It did not rely on greed. It relied on comfort. It relied on the belief that a seasoned expert could guide people safely through the dangers of the market. Even when analysts flagged problems in his options strategy, the warnings failed to break through. Many financial professionals decided there must be some hidden edge they did not understand. They convinced themselves that his decades of experience granted him a sense for timing that others lacked. They accepted logical gaps because the myth was easier to believe than the alternative. Madoff's office remained divided. The legitimate trading floor was visible to visitors. Phones rang, screens updated, trades moved quickly. That part of the company looked like a strong operation. It supported his credibility. The fraudulent advisory arm stayed hidden. Only a small group handled the statements. They knew how to generate false trade confirmations. They knew how to produce monthly returns. They used dated equipment because that created fewer questions. The old printers could produce continuous forms with a professional appearance. The consistency made the results look authentic. Throughout these years, Madoff managed his relationships carefully. He attended charity events. He offered advice without sounding arrogant. He guided institutions during times of uncertainty. Each interaction built more trust. Each endorsement from a satisfied client brought in more capital. He understood that social networks were more powerful than marketing. He focused on building loyalty. This chapter of the story is defined by how many people wanted to believe in him. Investors saw friends getting steady returns and assumed they should join. Boards of charities accepted him because their peers did. Banks looked at their wealthiest clients investing with him and followed. This clustering effect gave the illusion of stability. When people see others they trust making the same choice, they feel reassured. They assume the decision is safe. By 2007, the scheme was enormous. New investors continued to line up. The illusion still held. Red flags were visible to those who wanted to see them, but most people looked away. They believed the image he projected. They believed the statements. They believed the returns. They believed the man. As the global economy moved toward the crisis of 2008, pressure built. Withdrawals increased. Questions returned. But during the long stretch before the collapse, the illusion had survived every test. It had survived regulatory visits. It had survived skeptical analysts. It had survived market swings. Through all of it, one question grew louder. If so many red flags existed for so long, how did one man shield himself from scrutiny? The answer remained buried under layers of status, routine, and trust. Those layers protected him right up until the moment everything began to crack. Chapter 2: Cracks in the Fortress. Long before the collapse, long before the confession inside the penthouse, the first real cracks appeared in the lives of the people who trusted Bernie Madoff most. They did not see them as cracks. They saw them as small concerns or random delays. They received their monthly statements. They saw their balances rise. They felt secure. But beneath that sense of security, the fraud had entered a stage where the damage to real people was no longer abstract. It was personal, immediate, and irreversible. By the early 2000s, Madoff's investor list had expanded across several continents. The victims covered every category of wealth. Some were retirees who had saved for decades. Some were families who had managed money through generations. There were universities with endowments built over a century of fundraising. There were charities with missions tied directly to the funds they believed were growing in Madoff's accounts. Global banks invested through feeder funds, with sums large enough to influence entire portfolios. The scheme did not target a single group. It caught anyone who believed stability was worth trusting. Retirees were among the most devoted clients. For many, their Madoff account represented their entire life savings. They relied on the monthly returns to plan for the future. Some used the false gains to support medical needs. Some supported children or grandchildren. They made long-term decisions based on the belief that their money was safe. Charities depended on his consistency. They used his reported returns to fund scholarships, community programs, and medical research. These organizations believed his stability allowed them to make multi-year commitments without fear of losing support. they saw him as the dependable foundation of their budgets. Universities invested, hoping to preserve capital while expanding opportunities. They believed the steady returns would allow them to build new programs and fund student aid. They assigned these funds with confidence. International banks invested through feeder funds that viewed Madoff as a safe, low-volatility anchor. These banks trusted the managers who vouched for him. When they saw positive returns year after year, their confidence grew. While the victims lived their lives without suspicion, a small group of analysts continued to question the numbers. Harry Markopoulos became the most persistent. He started analyzing Madoff's strategy around 2000 after a manager asked him to replicate the returns. Markopoulos reviewed the method. He ran calculations. Nothing worked. The numbers refused to align with any known version of the split strike strategy. After more study, he reached a conclusion that would guide him for nearly a decade. The returns were impossible. He reported his concerns to the Securities and Exchange Commission. He explained the math. He submitted detailed documents. He demonstrated how Madoff's results violated basic principles of options pricing. He wrote that the fraud was likely the largest Ponzi scheme in the history of the financial markets. His warnings were clear and organized. They showed the discrepancy between claim and reality, but his reports did not lead to immediate action. Inside the SEC, investigations were opened, closed, reopened, and redirected. Communication between offices failed repeatedly. One team believed another team was handling the review. Another believed they lacked jurisdiction. Some investigators accepted partial documents without pushing for more. Others assumed that Madoff's reputation made deeper scrutiny unnecessary. His status created an invisible barrier. Regulators saw him as a respected figure, not a suspect. Markopoulos continued filing additional reports. He updated his analysis. He expanded his evidence. He presented his findings to different officers. Despite this persistence, the warnings did not break through. The SEC visited Madoff's firm, but accepted his explanations. They reviewed certain documents, but did not cross-check with external market data. They believed the trading floor they saw represented all of his operations. They did not demand proof of actual trades for the advisory accounts. The visits were not confrontational. Madoff remained calm and cooperative. That demeanor reassured them. While regulators missed the deeper issues, the internal structure of the fraud grew more dependent on secrecy. The fake operations floor, sometimes called the back office, became essential. Inside that room, a small team printed account statements using outdated machines that did not draw digital attention. These statements showed trades that never occurred. They showed option positions that were never purchased. They showed gains that were never earned. The printers hummed day after day, creating the appearance of reality on paper. To outsiders, the physical setup looked harmless. The room had old equipment, stacks of forms, and workers who handled endless paperwork. But everything inside that room served the fraud. When clients requested withdrawals, the team updated balances manually. Transactions were typed out. Confirmations were generated without reference to any trading platform. The system was designed to avoid scrutiny. The more outdated it appeared, the less likely anyone was to question it. During the early 2000s, market conditions tested the scheme. Technology stocks surged and then collapsed. Investors grew nervous. Some withdrew. Others added more, believing that Madoff's steady returns were proof of superior discipline. These shifts forced the fraud to adjust. The operation relied on constant inflows. When withdrawals increased faster than deposits, stress began to rise. The global economy shifted again around 2003 and 2004. Some institutions tightened their requirements. They asked for clearer documentation. Madoff offered vague explanations. He insisted the strategy protected them from most downturns. Their doubts eased because the statements showed stability. Still, withdrawals created pressure. Madoff managed this by relying more heavily on feeder funds. These funds brought in large sums. They reduced the need for Madoff to manage relationships directly with each investor. They also created a buffer between him and the questions some clients asked. When concerns arose, feeder fund managers reassured their clients they believed in Madoff. Their voices held weight. The trust cycle continued. Inside the SEC, Markopoulos remained frustrated. he watched the returns continue without a single month of verifiable volatility. He compared the numbers to market benchmarks. The mismatch was obvious to him. He submitted another memorandum describing the red flags. He argued that Madoff must be engaged in either insider trading or a Ponzi scheme. He believed the latter was far more likely. His warnings again went unheeded. By 2005, the volume of investor money inside the scheme had reached a level that made the risks enormous. If the withdrawals ever exceeded incoming funds by a large margin, the entire operation could collapse in days. Madoff knew this. He monitored flows constantly. His survival depended on maintaining confidence. As long as people believed in him, the fraud continued. But belief began to waver for some. Financial professionals who had ignored earlier warnings started to revisit the numbers. They asked why Madoff's returns never reflected market swings. They questioned why he did not disclose counterparties. They noted that the strategy he claimed to use required trading volumes that would have been visible in the options markets, but those trades did not appear anywhere. Some funds considered withdrawing fully. Others requested more detailed statements. Madoff responded with selective transparency. He provided documents that appeared legitimate but masked the underlying fraud. He argued that secrecy protected the strategy from being copied. This explanation appealed to investors who believed he was uniquely skilled. By mid-2007, the cracks inside the system had widened. Market pressures increased. Withdrawals became more frequent. Investors who needed liquidity requested redemptions. Madoff approved them. He had no choice. Denying requests would create panic. But each withdrawal strained the scheme. The 2008 financial crisis accelerated everything. Markets collapsed. Banks tightened their controls. Investors demanded their money back. They needed liquidity to cover losses in other areas. Madoff's operation could not withstand the surge of redemptions. He had relied on new money to pay old obligations. Now, new money slowed sharply. Feeder funds could not keep pace. Some of them faced their own crises. They struggled to gather capital. This placed enormous pressure on Madoff. His back office team worked around the clock. They prepared statements that still showed gains even as global markets suffered historic losses. They printed documents that claimed trades occurred on days when no liquidity existed. They attempted to preserve the illusion, but the illusion depended on withdrawals remaining manageable. As the crisis intensified, withdrawals surged to levels the scheme could not sustain. Clients smelled uncertainty. Some demanded meetings. They asked direct questions. Madoff reassured them with the same calm tone he had used for years. He said the strategy was safe. He said they would be fine. But he knew the gap between incoming and outgoing funds was now too wide. He could not fill it. For nearly two decades, he had relied on trust. Now that trust was starting to erode. Once the illusion weakened, clients viewed the same steady returns they once admired with renewed suspicion. They asked why he had never posted a down month. They asked how he had avoided the losses others faced. They asked why no one else could replicate his results. The fraud had entered a stage where maintenance required more than calm explanation. It required impossible sums of money. The financial crisis made those sums unreachable. By late 2008, the pressure was overwhelming. Investors requested billions in redemptions. The feeder funds were exhausted. The back office could not print confidence fast enough to replace the fear spreading across financial markets. Madoff knew the scheme was approaching a point of no return. Throughout this period, Markopoulos continued trying to draw attention to the fraud. He submitted additional evidence. He explained the mathematical impossibilities. He outlined the systemic risk. His warnings gained slightly more traction as the crisis worsened, but not enough to prompt a full-scale investigation before the collapse. By the first week of December 2008, the cracks were no longer just visible. They were structural. Madoff had run out of time. He had run out of inflows. He had run out of excuses. Investors who once begged to enter his fund now demanded their money back. Banks that had trusted feeder funds questioned their exposure. Charities worried about their future budgets. Universities reconsidered their long-term plans. Retirees wondered if their savings were safe. The pressure reached its peak when Madoff faced redemption requests he could not meet. The sum was too large. There was no hidden reserve. There were no real trades to unwind. There was only the truth. His sons noticed the strain. They asked questions. They saw parts of the operation that did not align. The moment was near. For years, the scheme had survived because belief outweighed doubt. Now the balancing point had shifted. Doubt outweighed belief. And when doubt takes over, a Ponzi scheme cannot survive. The stage was set for the final break. Chapter 3, The Collapse. The final days of Bernie Madoff's empire did not unfold with slow realization. They came fast, driven by numbers that no longer obeyed the illusion he had built. By early December 2008, redemption requests surged past $7 billion. That number was far larger than the available cash because there was no real cash. There had never been enough to meet the demands of a full liquidation. Madoff had spent decades maintaining the belief that the investment strategy could withstand any market condition. Now, in a matter of days, the truth revealed itself. Without new money, the scheme had no foundation. Inside his office, the tension was impossible to hide. His staff noticed him pacing, silent and distracted. His sons, Andrew and Mark, sensed a shift in his behavior. He avoided direct questions. He handled paperwork with long, heavy pauses. He had always carried himself with calm discipline. Now, for the first time, the mask cracked. He started missing details. He repeated instructions. He acted like a man carrying a weight that finally exceeded his strength. The back office team still printed statements, even as the world outside collapsed. They generated documents showing fictional gains while the markets delivered historic losses. The statements were consistent with the fraud, not with reality. These papers carried no power anymore. Investors no longer cared about printed results. They wanted cash. They needed liquidity. They needed what the scheme could never provide. On December 9, 2008, Madoff called his sons into his office. The meeting started without preamble. He told them the business was finished. He said he could not continue. He said that the advisory arm was not what they believed it was. When they pressed him for clarity, he delivered the most consequential admission of his life. He told them it was all one big lie. He said he had been running a Ponzi scheme for years. He did not say the exact number of years. He did not outline the full damage. He admitted only that the entire operation was unsustainable and had reached its end. The confession landed like a blow. His sons were not involved in the fraud. They did not help manufacture statements. They did not work in the back office. They had managed parts of the legitimate trading operations. They believed their father when he said the advisory business was separate. Now they understood what that separation meant. It meant distance. It meant concealment. It meant they had been excluded, not because the strategy was proprietary, but because it was non-existent. Shocked and shaken, they left the office and contacted their attorney. They explained what their father had told them. The attorney instructed them to alert federal authorities immediately. Within hours, the information reached the FBI and prosecutors. The next morning, agents prepared to confront Madoff. On December 11, agents arrived at the penthouse. They entered calmly. They found Madoff standing near the entrance. He did not resist. He did not attempt to stall. He did not deny what they already knew. When the agents asked if there was an innocent explanation, he replied that there was none. He said the scheme was insolvent. He estimated the losses at about $50 billion. The actual figure would take years to calculate, measured in both real and paper losses, but his estimate gave investigators a sense of the unprecedented scale. From that moment, the story shifted from suspicion to fact. The investigation moved quickly. Staff members were questioned. Records were seized. Offices were searched. Agents separated the legitimate trading floor from the fraudulent advisory operation. They documented the machinery used to create false statements. They catalogued the fake trade blotters. They traced the flow of money from new investors to older ones. As the scope grew clearer, the list of victims expanded far beyond the early estimates. Feeder funds reported billions in exposure. Charities revealed endowment losses. Universities uncovered gaps in budgets. Retirees realized their life savings were gone. Wealthy individuals and institutions discovered that accounts they believed were safe had no actual assets behind them. The impact was global. European banks reported significant losses. Latin American investors traced exposure through complex financial channels. Philanthropic foundations faced crises of survival. Some had to shut down entirely. Families with long-standing trust structures found themselves financially devastated. While investigators pieced together the damage, attention turned to the legal process. Madoff's attorneys initially discussed possible strategies, but the evidence was overwhelming. Witnesses were prepared to testify. Documents contradicted every legitimate claim. The fake statements showed patterns impossible to defend. A trial would expose enormous detail and prolong the suffering of victims. On March 12, 2009, in federal court in Manhattan, Madoff entered a guilty plea. He admitted to 11 felony counts, including securities fraud, wire fraud, mail fraud, money laundering, perjury, and theft from employee benefit plans. He acknowledged that the advisory business had been a Ponzi scheme from the beginning. He did not fight the charges. He did not challenge the narrative. He accepted responsibility in a tone that investigators later described as calm and emotionless. During sentencing, victims spoke about their losses. They described retirement plans destroyed, homes sold, medical care delayed, and futures rewritten. Charities described the loss of programs that had supported communities for decades. Universities described cancelled scholarships and halted research. The courtroom became a record of the human cost behind the numbers. On June 29, 2009, the judge sentenced Madoff to 150 years in federal prison. The sentence was symbolic as much as punitive. It ensured he would never be free again. It acknowledged the scale of the damage. It sent a message to financial markets about accountability. After sentencing, attention turned to recovery. The Department of Justice and the trustee, Irving Picard, launched one of the largest asset recovery efforts in American history. Picard pursued clawbacks from feeder funds and others who had withdrawn more than they originally invested. He navigated complex international banking systems. He traced money through multiple layers of financial structures. His goal was simple: recover as much as possible for victims. Over the next decade, the recovery effort produced surprising results. Billions were returned to victims through legal settlements and clawback actions. Some investors recuperated significant portions of their losses. Others recovered only a fraction. For those who lost retirement savings or sold homes, the financial recovery did not erase the emotional damage. Many victims expressed relief, but not closure. The collapse of the scheme inflicted deep wounds on Madoff's own family. In December 2010, his son Mark died by suicide. His father's actions had left him under intense public scrutiny, legal pressure, and emotional strain. In 2014, his other son, Andrew, died after a prolonged illness. Both men had lived with the consequences of a crime they had not committed, but could not escape. His wife, Ruth, withdrew from public life. She cooperated with authorities. She forfeited significant assets. She lived with the fallout of a marriage built on trust she later discovered was misplaced. Her life changed permanently. The collapse reshaped regulatory oversight. Agencies reviewed where they had failed. Reports detailed miscommunications, assumptions, and missed opportunities. Training improved. Cross-office communication was revised. Risk models changed. The Madoff case became a permanent reference point in discussions about oversight gaps and financial systems vulnerable to fraud. Despite these changes, one question remained unresolved. How had such a large, long-running fraud survived inside a highly regulated market? The answer was complex. It involved reputation, complacency, trust, and the tendency of people to believe what feels safe. It involved regulators who accepted surface-level answers. It involved a financial culture that often treated prestige as proof. Before the collapse, Madoff appeared untouchable. After it, he became a global symbol of deception. His scheme revealed structural weaknesses that had existed for decades, but remained hidden until the crisis forced them into the open. In federal prison, Madoff spent his final years in deteriorating health. He filed unsuccessful appeals for compassionate release. He died in April 2021, leaving behind a legacy defined entirely by the fraud. What remained were the victims rebuilding their lives, the institutions adjusting their systems, and the financial world confronting the truth about how easily trust can be manipulated. The case became more than a story about one man. it became a study in oversight, belief, and vulnerability. Even after recovery efforts returned billions, the real cost could not be measured in numbers alone. Trust once broken does not return fully. Systems once exposed require constant vigilance. Communities once harmed carry the memory. The collapse of the largest Ponzi scheme in modern history left the financial world with a final question that echoed long after the courtroom closed. If a fraud of this scale could live in plain sight for decades, what other dangers remain hidden behind confidence, success, and the belief that reputation equals truth?